Vuoreen ehkä puokkaita. Ja kiitos ollut läide sitten tämän konferenssan läidämistä Päivin Järkkässä.
Good evening everyone. I'd like to thank Professor Päivi Naskali and all the other conference organizers for the invitation and all the organizers also who have made this conference happen. This early June in Rovaniemi, it's a beautiful time of the year when the leaves are just coming out. It is a great honor to be speaking to you this evening. And I was very intrigued by the research project by Professor Naskali mentioned that her colleagues have or are engaged in the Are We Allowed to Leave? Because like Professor Naskali just said, I left, though I've been here for this past year working on my book that I will be talking a little bit about tonight. But like I said, I'm currently working in Toronto, but this is my home, and it's been very good to be back after so many years in Canada. So this is the title of my talk, Indigenous Self-Determination from the Politics of Recognition to Restructuring Relations. In 1978, 14 Sami women occupied the Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland's office in Oslo, Norway, as part of a broader ongoing demonstrations to object the government's plan to build a dam, hydroelectric dam, in the Alta-Kautokeino River and flood the major reindeer herding and calving area and an adjacent Sami community of Maate, or Maasi, in the heart of the Sami region. The Prime Minister met with the Sami women, but left the meeting after half an hour. With their demands unmet, the women refused to leave the Prime Minister's office, and the next morning the police had to carry the women out. In 34 years later, in November 2012, four Indigenous women from Western Canada got together and decided to do something about the federal government's tabled Bill C-45, the Omnibus Budget Implementation Bill with wide-ranging effects on Indigenous and environmental issues, among others. What started as a series of grassroots teachings organized by these two women, four women in Saskatchewan, snowballed into organized protests and rallies across the country. In less than 2 months, the Idle No More movement, founded to raise awareness of Indigenous issues, gained a serious following and significant media attention through rallies, teachings, and social media. In February 2015, which is just a couple of months ago, two Sami young musicians and sisters, Maxida and Mimi Marak, staged a small but powerful demonstration in Jokkmokk at the front of Alice Bah Kuhnke, the Minister of Culture and Democracy, responsible also for the Sami affairs in Sweden. In the demo, Maxida cut her sister's hair while Mimi read aloud to the minister what they called the Sami Manifesto, consisting of 9 points which focus on the importance of the land and the dependence of human beings on the well-being of the land. And this really relates also to the topic of the conference, the capital, and the kind of, especially northern Sweden lately, in the past few years, there's been very strong pressure on the exploitation, especially mining companies encroaching the territories in that part of the country. These are only a few examples of the meaning and practice of self-determination for Indigenous women. In my talk titled Indigenous Self-Determination from the Politics of Recognition to Restructuring Relations, I'm going to consider some of the ways in which Indigenous women discuss self-determination. My talk draws on work in progress, which I hope will be in the near future a book. I've been working on this the past 9 months, and now I'm going to take a break. My body is giving up. But hopefully it will be a book soon. And this is based on research and fieldwork in the past 4 years with the Inuit in Greenland, Sami in the Nordic countries, and Indigenous peoples in the three regions of Canada. As part of my research project called Gendering Self-Determination, funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Council of Canada, I have conducted nearly 100 interviews, mostly with women, ranging from grassroots to leading politicians, with an objective to find answers to two broad questions. how the processes of gendering have hindered, one, inclusion of women, women's perceptions on self-determination in self-governance arrangements and institutions, and two, addressing violence against Indigenous women. Like, these are the big two issues. Like, if you talk to Indigenous women anywhere in the world, they're like, these are the big issues, that perhaps the biggest issues and most important, they consider most important issues, but they are never discussed together. So some years ago, I was thinking, like, why don't we talk about self-determination and violence against Indigenous women together, while they're both, well, obvious links, but we don't discuss these issues simultaneously. So with regard to the first point, I have asked questions such as, what does self-determination mean to Indigenous women? How are the different levels of individual and collective self-determination conceptualized, articulated, and negotiated by these women? How are the different levels... With regard to the second point, I have focused on following questions. How can self-determination as a concept and practice be made to address the sometimes disproportionate levels of violence against Indigenous women? What kind of self-governance arrangements and structures need to be in place in order to effectively address the problem of gendered violence and protect Indigenous women from violence in their own communities? In this work, violence is broadly understood consisting of physical, interpersonal violence, but also structural, institutional, spiritual, and cultural violence. For the past few years, Indigenous feminists, particularly in the US and Canada, have been mounting radical critiques of Indigenous self-government and the nation-state. This can be seen in the I'll Know More, but also lesser-known initiatives and grassroots activism, such as the Women's Water Walk, No More Silence, and many others. Besides posing a compelling challenge to the status quo and the male-dominated power structures, these criticisms differ from the global Indigenous political discourse by arguing for another kind of self-determination than that of promoted in forums such as the United Nations. Rather than limiting the discourse to recognition, whether it's political or legal recognition, self-determination called for by many Indigenous women aims at fundamentally restructuring relations in society, mainstream and Indigenous alike. Elsewhere, such as in Greenland and the Nordic countries, Indigenous women are making great inroads in taking control of Indigenous political institutions and reconstructing previously male-dominated political institutions. The main argument I'm putting forward in my talk this evening is that Indigenous women define and articulate self-determination as an act of restructuring relationships rather than a call for a recognition of rights. These relationships take various forms and exist at different levels. Even those who refer to the state recognition articulate it in terms of the need to restructure the relations, ranging from personal to structural. And these structural relations include relations of negotiations, ownership, property, law, policy, and so on. For example, many Indigenous women emphasize the way in which individual and collective self-determination are inseparably linked. Yet this dimension is often overlooked in Indigenous politics. I argue that Indigenous women put forward a compelling notion of self-determination in which the colonial politics of recognition is replaced by a conception of restructuring relations. In order to create a point of comparison, I will first provide a brief overview of the prevailing political discourse of Indigenous self-determination. It has become, in the past 3 decades, increasingly studied and discussed topic. In the realm of international Indigenous politics, the collective right of Indigenous peoples to self-determination is considered a fundamental principle that allows the exercise of all other rights. The collective right to self-determination enables Indigenous peoples to remain as distinct peoples through having control of their own affairs, including their territories and traditional economies. In the words of Laatan Desbär, a longtime Sami politician, quote, the aim of our advocacy for our right to self-determination has nothing to do with the creation of Western-style nation-states. We are only trying to get a greater control over our lives and future. So at the heart of the Indigenous self-determination is the ongoing struggle against the continuing dispossession of indigenous peoples from the territories, like I already mentioned, this is kind of related to the capital theme, which has resulted in the loss of control of their own destinies and distinct entities. The reason for the centrality of the land for indigenous peoples is because the land constitutes not only the geographical and physical territories and thus the source of subsistence for many, but in the words of the 2013 Lima Declaration of Indigenous Women, quote, also the profound cultural, social and spiritual relationships, values and responsibilities that connect us to the ancestral homelands. This perception is commonly expressed in terms of the land being the source of indigenous people's identity. Without the connection to the land due to the ongoing dispossession and displacement, this identity can be lost. In other words, land is considered the foundation of the integrity as indigenous peoples. Under international law, the right to self-determination guarantees the people to freely determine their political status and pursue their economic, social and cultural development. This right is now affirmed also with regard to indigenous peoples in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was adopted in 2007. The implementation of this right would mean not only that indigenous peoples can remain who they are and live the way they want to live, but also to allow decision-making of their own affairs, practicing their own laws, customs and land tenure systems through their own institutions, and in accordance to the practices, their own practices and traditions. In sum, the quest for affirmation of the indigenous people's right to self-determination is a quest for justice and equal standing with other peoples. So under international law, all peoples have the right to self-determination, and as the Global Indigenous Caucus has maintained for decades, indigenous peoples cannot be excluded from this right. In contrast, indigenous women commonly discuss self-determination entirely outside the discourse of rights. Many indigenous women prefer to define and discuss self-determination in terms of values. They hold important rather than in terms of rights. Self-determination is something indigenous women consider fundamental to their individual and collective well-being and future. So you can argue that this self-determination is a core value that attempts to restructure these relations, also the state-indigenous relations. Defining it as a fundamental value does not necessarily require the rejection of the discourse of rights, which no doubt has its place in promoting justice in indigenous communities as well. And that's not what I'm arguing here. Obviously, there are similarities between the political discourse and the way in which indigenous women discuss self-determination. Notably, for instance, land is central for both discourses, but whereas the political discourse revolves around the language of rights, indigenous women tend to discuss it as a fundamental value constituted by relationships and responsibilities. The land itself is a relation, and some women stress the importance of being a good relative to all living beings. The land is also a source for relations of spirituality. Land as a relation gives rise to responsibilities which take individual and collective forms and are often gender-specific. Women are considered to possess particular responsibilities for protecting the land and water for their children and future generations. This is what they emphasize often themselves. It's clear that defining self-determination as a core value restructuring relations does not mean that all indigenous women discuss and understand self-determination in the same way. The value manifests itself in a variety of ways in different contexts and on different levels. It is shaped in particular by specific geographical contexts and informed by specific histories and cultures. In this talk, rather than delving into the specific geopolitical differences between the three jurisdictions or regions, however, I'm going to focus on some of the conceptual similarities that can be drawn from these different contexts. In the political discourse, indigenous self-determination is often discussed in terms of a relationship between indigenous peoples and states, which could be characterized simultaneously as colonial and post-colonial. Colonial because indigenous peoples appear still dependent on the recognition of the quote-unquote colonial masters, to use the terminology by Fanon, and echo the recent criticism of the colonial politics of recognition. and post-colonial as an aspiration toward an acclaim for greater equality with the states, which is expected and assumed to follow the recognition of the right. So this international indigenous political and legal discourse has long revolved around the state recognition of indigenous rights, particularly the right of self-determination, which I said is the kind of the fundamental right. This focus has been so extensive and exclusive of other aspects of this right that indigenous self-determination has become constructed only or mostly in terms of its relationship with the state. I argue, based on the discussions with other women, it's inadequate since it focuses only on the hegemonic colonial relations with the state and obscures and disregards other, sometimes more fundamental relations that constitute indigenous self-determination. It is also inadequate because, as argued by Danish political scientist Glenn Coldheart, the current politics of recognition does not restructure the colonial relations between the state and indigenous peoples, but amounts only to reconciliation and accommodation of indigenous peoples' claims within existing state hegemony, which allows the dispossession to continue. While Coldheart's analysis pertains to the Canadian context, I think it also has merit in the context of discussing indigenous self-determination more broadly. The international indigenous political and legal discourse has also focused almost exclusively on the rights aspects of indigenous self-determination. While rights have always been shaped by relationships, as a feminist legal scholar, and if I may add, my colleague at the University of Toronto, Jennifer Nedelsky, notes, the problem has been that rights discourse effectively conceals and ignores relationships. Nedelsky distinguishes the terms rights and value. Value for Nedelsky implies, quote, any of the big abstractions used to articulate what a given society sees as essential to humanity or to the good life for its members. Rights, in her definition, are, quote, a particular institutional and rhetorical means of expressing, contesting, and implementing these values. These values range from equality, dignity, security, autonomy, and bodily integrity to adequate material resources, individual and or collective spiritual expression, and respect for the earth. And these are just some of them. Nedelsky also acknowledges that different societies may understand this and other values differently, and that they can conflict with another in practical implementation. So they are always contested as well. The way in which Indigenous women discuss and understand self-determination removes it from the hegemonic of state relations and the politics of recognition to a transformative process of restructuring relations. For most Indigenous women, self-determination is about relations to others, family, community, place, land, and other living beings, and as one woman put it, about the responsibility of being good relative in these various relationships. Being a good relative does not imply that there are no tensions or disequilibrium in those relationships, but rather, as Indigenous feminist author and educator Lee Maracle puts it, that you determine yourself within your relations, making connections with all living beings. Fundamentally, in her view, the relational definition of self-determination means that we aren't self-determinate outside those relations. A conception of self-determination as restructuring relations is informed by a profoundly relational concept of self rather than a separative self. Relational self for Indigenous women means that the individual dimension is crucial and essential, but it cannot be separated from the broader relations, from the community. So in the project, the women involved in the project, many included the individual dimension in their definition. Like, how do you understand this concept? And they included the individual dimension as a key part. Some talk about it as the responsibility and role of an individual in relation to a collective, the clan, community, the nation. Such an understanding of individual self-determination is different from conventional liberal feminist values of individual self-determination, choice and autonomy, because the individual is always considered to exist in relation to others. In this context, for example, for a Haisla woman in British Columbia, Jackie Green, self-determination means, and this is a quote, coming to know your own history as your own identity, and understanding and coming to know the history of a people, the location to place, understanding cultural knowledge, cultural ceremonies, and how those have been a form of governance, how those have been a form of leadership, and how those protocols that we do in ceremony was actually our policies and procedures. End of quote. Related to the individual dimension, a number of Indigenous women from all three regions discussed self-determination in terms of being determined. Maria Simonsen, a Greenlander who teaches journalism at Ilisi Matusarfik, which is the University of Greenland, includes the individual dimension in her definition of self-determination and discusses the concept through two rights movements that are women and nationhood. And this is also a quote. Self-determination. I was part of this movement, this women's movement, from the old days. We lived the years that was very crucial to self-determination, women's self-determination in Scandinavia. But we had apart from that, our struggle for self-determination as a nation. So these two matters have been following each other all the time. And when we often discussed what is the most important, women's self-determination or our determination as a people. I think women are very determined. Greenlandic women are very determined. We were at least in our generation. Simonsen's understanding of self-determination arises from the context and era of civil rights movements of the 1960s and 70s. Self-determination is a core value for both women and the Greenlandic Inuit, although in different ways. Hence the question which is more important. For her, the two related struggles for self-determination are informed by one another, but more importantly, determination is a quality that characterizes Greenlandic women, in her view. This sentiment of determination was shared by a number of others. For Anishinaabeg woman Janet Corbier-Lavelle, in Ontario, the word self-determination connotes above all the determination of women in their traditional roles. And in traditional roles, I don't mean only, and she doesn't mean only the kind of like the feminine roles, but also political roles and other and leadership roles and responsibilities of leadership and decision-making, but also of everyday life. The revival and reclaiming of Indigenous women's political and other roles, authority and leadership is perhaps the most explicit example of self-determination as restructuring relations. Diane Retzky from Charles Lake First Nation in Ontario defines self-determination as reclaiming women's traditional roles and responsibilities in decision-making and leadership in the community. She has herself been part of numerous initiatives herself, including one with grandmothers who are saying enough is enough, and reclaiming their roles with regard to the well-being, the leadership in their community and the well-being and protection of children from violence abuse. So then I think I put that slide a little early there, but Corbier-Lavelle was among the first to question the current state of relations and expressed her desire to restructure and transform them by taking the government, this is the federal government of Canada, to court in the early 1970s. She was really the pioneering women who are leading figures in the Native or Indigenous women's movement in Canada. In her case, Corbier-Lavelle argued that the Indian Act violated Canada's Bill of Rights and its prohibition against discrimination on the basis of sex. Without going into too much detail, before the amendments to the Indian Act in 1985, all First Nations Indigenous women in Canada who married non-First Nations men lost their Indian status under the Indian Act enacted in 1879. Without this status, a woman would lose all rights and benefits commonly associated with membership in a federally recognized Indian community, including the rights to reside on the reserve and receive housing there. Corbier-Lavelle suing the government represents an example of self-determination in which the individual determination is shaped and informed by broader social relations. referring to this case, ironically, my own dilemma with the government and the Indian Act, she relates how she was able to take on the legal challenge because she was brought up to think that, quote, if there was anything that I wanted to do and I believed in it, it was worth pursuing. However, she did not make a decision without speaking to her family first. Quote, I didn't just go ahead and do it on my own, but I said this is what I would like to do. End of quote. Most of her family supported her, including her parents. Also, the chief of the community was supportive of her case, although many of the men in her community were not. Corbière Lavelle's discussion demonstrates how self-determination, I guess I should mention, in Canada, we talk, kind of familiar with the kind of the Indian Act. It's very specific, like it only excluded women. It also only applied to women who married white men. It didn't apply the vice versa. So it's very, very, very gender specific sex, and hence the sex discrimination. And the amendments that were made in 1985 did not fully address this problem, and the case is still ongoing. The person beside Corbière Lavelle in the picture, Sharon McIver, is another person who has been in court with the federal government trying to amend the residual sex discrimination in the Act, and the case is ongoing. So Corbière Lavelle's discussion demonstrates how self-determination, understood as an individual determination, is not the same as the individual autonomy conceived by traditional liberal theory, although those opposing her case against gender discrimination, including male-led organizations like the National Indian Brotherhood, that later became the Assembly of First Nations, presented as such, and argued that it goes squarely against Indigenous collective self-determination. In other words, that gender we cannot talk about gender discrimination at the same time while we talk about collective self-determination. And the way in which she discusses self-determination and individual determination is deeply embedded in social relations. Nedelsky's discussion, the legal scholar I mentioned, of a relational conception of autonomy, sheds light to the notion of self-determination as individual determination embedded in social relations. And Nedelsky argues that by rejecting the equation of autonomy with independence, relational autonomy recognizes that, quote, every person is in significant part constituted by her interactions by others. Drawing on Nedelsky's work, Cree feminist legal scholar Val Napoleon argues that individuals, quote, need to be recognized as agents in the fullest sense of the term and to be self-governing in a relational way. And she elaborates, I'm not talking about atomistic individuals. We are never separate from the background from which we understand the world. Yet relationships, as we feminists, we know, can be both a source of autonomy and a radical restriction to it. Thus, the relational approach does not focus on relationships in order to automatically validate them or to argue for the preservation, but in order to be able to distinguish between structures of relations that are oppressive and those that are supportive and fostering. Oppressive relations are far from unknown for Indigenous women, and not surprisingly, many define self-determination as freedom from coercion and violence. This means freedom from all levels of aggression, which inevitably are connected, very interconnected, ranging from structural, systemic inequality embedded in laws and policies to physical, sexual and psychological abuse and torture, including the apprehension and removal of Indigenous children from their families and communities, which has been particularly the case in the Canadian context. For several Sami women, self-determination personally means the will and responsibility of teaching their children the Sami language and identity in a Sami environment, including working towards ensuring the existence of Sami daycare, schools and books for children. Related, others saw it as an individual ability to decide what language to learn and to speak and what values to possess. Some Sami women discussed the personal significance of self-determination in terms of taking responsibility either for one's own actions, both good and bad, as they affect other people around her, or, as one Greenlandic woman put it, taking responsibility for being a role model for young women and teach them leadership in a such way that enables to put an end to the prevailing ethos of colonial dependence on the government. Further, the way in which many Indigenous women talk about the personal significance of self-determination corresponds to Nedelsky's discussion of autonomy as finding one's law. She recognizes the complex nature of the concept of autonomy and how many theorists critical of its ties to classical liberal thought as independence and rational agency devoid of connection have rejected the term. She holds, however, that autonomy is such an important value for feminism and other transformative projects that we need to reconceptualize rather than dismiss it altogether. The complexity and significance of the term, Nedelsky argues, is embedded in the literal meaning of autonomy as governed by one's own law. In other words, to become autonomous is to come to be able to find and live in accordance with one's own law. So becoming, instead of being, autonomous emphasizes the process of developing the capability for finding one's own law, and finding draws attention to the fact that instead of individuals making or choosing their own law, it is, quote, shaped by the society in which one lives and the relationships that are part of one's life. End of quote. So before concluding, I want to say a few words about what this all means in practice. And the practice, I mean here, the negotiating and implementing Indigenous self-government, the process that are ongoing in various parts of the world and in the three regions that I'm focusing on in very different ways, yet it all comes under the rubric of Indigenous governance. When discussing Indigenous women and self-determination, there's a common assumption about a fundamental conflict between the individual and collective self-determination. I also already alluded to this with the Corbière case. Indigenous women bringing forward their conceptions of self-determination have often been considered divisive and disruptive, particularly by Indigenous male leadership. The common argument has been that dismissively constructed women's issues need to be put on a back burner to be addressed later, once collective self-determination has been achieved. Issues of concern for Indigenous women have commonly constructed as an opposition to self-determination, this idea of collective self-determination, and women's concerns have not been part of Indigenous self-government institutions. Indigenous women, however, have for some time now argued that such an approach will merely replicate colonial and patriarchal political structures and ideologies. The crux of the problem, as the women in the project have insisted, is the categorical separation of issues into quote-unquote women's issues and then the self-determination issues. As long as this segregation occurs, adding more women into self-government institutions will not change the gender power relations that ultimately is stacked not only against Indigenous women, but as Indigenous women themselves argue, the very implementation process of self-determination and Indigenous governance. In other words, there's no point talking about implementing Indigenous governance as long as we separate these issues, that women's issues are there as if they are not part of building communities and governance institutions. Indigenous women involved in the project have made it very clear that an interrogation squaring in on gender specifically not only needs to urgently happen, but that an understanding of gender must be incorporated into self-government discourses so that we can move beyond the counterproductive politics of separating priorities put forward. As Indigenous women in the project attest, and as I have argued, the women's issues are not merely about gender equality, but they are fundamentally as much as governance issues as any others. That also extends this idea of gendering self-determination. Thus, for Indigenous women, the only tension between individual and collective self-determination exists in the tendency to disregard the grassroots and the day-to-day self-determination endeavors and accomplishments while focusing on political statements and the discourse of rights. Instead, the two dimensions inform and constitute one another in several fundamental ways in a manner that makes it difficult to discuss or conceive one without the other. So in conclusion, what I have argued is that Indigenous women define and discuss self-determination in ways often radically different from the dominant political and legal discourse at the forums like the UN, but also at national levels. They emphasize how we cannot talk about Indigenous self-determination without starting from the individual. However, this individual is not an atomistic agent of independence, but always embedded in social relations. Indigenous self-determination is therefore fundamentally about seeing ourselves in relation to others in a way that does not subsume the individual in the collective or idealize all relationships as positive. Indigenous women know well how relations can also be extremely oppressive, whether structural or social, collective or individual. As a core value that restructures relations, self-determination moves beyond a state-centric relationship embedded in the discourse of the recognition of Indigenous rights. However, I do not argue, nor Indigenous women who participated in the project suggest that we do away with rights, although some participants are highly critical of the rights talk. The reality is that rights are a powerful rhetorical tool in struggles for justice all around the world, including Indigenous communities and peoples. So, and finally, conceptualized as finding one's law, Indigenous self-determination is the process of finding and developing one's values and demands in relation to others, to other individuals, families, other communities, to the state and to its law, policies and institutions. Thank you very much for your attention.